This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Odyssey. Your Radio Doctor does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, products, physicians, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on Your Radio Doctor. Always consult your own physician. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, WPHT, HD, WOGL, HD3, Philadelphia. From the Cherry Hill Volvo Studios, where relationships matter. Always live on the free Odyssey app. It's time for the Delaware Valley's first radio doctor.
On call every Saturday afternoon at 5.
This is Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie. Presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
Listen, 7 months or 10 months is an absolutely exceptionally short time frame to produce this vaccine.
Your health determines your life, your longevity, and your happiness. Let your radio doctor lead the way with your medical education. Your radio doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie.
Good afternoon and welcome to Your Radio Doctor. I'm your host, Dr. Marianne Ritchie. In July of this year, the Wall Street Journal published an article called How Much Alcohol Can You Drink a Week and Still Be Healthy? It was written by Sumathi Reddy, and the discussion refers to warnings from scientists about the potential health problems if you consume even small amounts of alcohol. Today, we welcome the return of one of our favorite guests, Dr. Michael Lucy, world-class hepatologist that's a liver specialist, and he's also a specialist in liver transplant medicine. Michael Ronan Lucy, he's an MD and a PhD, a professor of medicine, and the former chief of the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology. He also served as the medical director of the Liver Transplant Program at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health in Madison, Wisconsin. He has an international reputation for his clinical skills and research and has held several leadership positions in the American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases. Welcome, Michael.
Well, I was worried whether we'd have enough to talk about, but with that length of an introduction, Marianne, half the time is already gone. So I'm protected.
Oh, my gosh. Well, did I mention he's also very charming? So this is going to be a great show. Michael, the CDC, Center for Disease Control, reports that excess alcohol can have immediate and or long-term negative effects. The American Cancer Society defines moderate alcohol intake as 2 servings of alcohol a day or less for a man and 1 drink or less per day for women. More recently, the Department of Health and Human Services came up with a recommendation that we would consider adults choose to drink in moderation or not to drink at all. What are the data that lead to these recommendations?
Well, they're emerging data, and they are challenging some older views that modest amount of alcohol might be helpful to health. That view is still persisting with some people, and also that the level at which harm occurs is quite high. And so we now are in a position of controversy, both to determine whether or not alcohol is ever healthy, and also to determine what level do we consider to be harmful and what at least to be innocuous. And the data come from worldwide studies and then specific studies in advanced countries like the United States and countries of Europe.
And so I guess if you consider all the different cultures, when you say worldwide, we had a great chat the other day and you mentioned, you know, not everyone would think about this. What about the cultures that use alcohol in their cooking and wouldn't add that to their amount of intake or just are exposed to alcohol in some other way? I did a year of nutrition fellowship after my GI training, and I learned that dietary intake if you look at two groups of people, one on a restricted diet and the other eat whatever you like, it's really hard to document what the group that's told just eat spontaneously, make your own choices, because they're going to maybe be inhibited. If they're used to eating three or four candy bars a day, they might be embarrassed to admit that. So they know they're being watched, the Hawthorne effect, and they might not either report what they take in accurately, or they may change their habits. So it kind of throws off the whole study. And I'm sure the same applies to alcohol intake. One person's drink might be, you know, a big glass and another's a small glass, even though we define it as...
Yeah. So all of the points you make there, Marianne, are accurate and reflect the challenges of acquiring meaningful data with regard to alcohol. There are cultural differences. There are many parts in the world where the social mores are strongly inhibitory of any alcohol. Societies in which alcohol is forbidden, for example. And then alcohol requires a certain amount of income or means. Even though it's relatively easy to produce, it requires means. So there are, it's estimated that half the adults in the world have not had any alcohol in the past year, whether because of the social mores or because of poverty, deep poverty. Another interesting statistic, which we mentioned yesterday, was that half of all the deaths from cirrhosis are alcohol-related deaths. Just in liver disease, half of the cirrhosis deaths are liver disease. Liver disease deaths from cirrhosis are alcohol-related. So on the one hand, you have a huge tranche of the world not drinking alcohol at all. And on the other hand, you have alcohol being a really serious medical problem in the parts of the world where people are drinking, or whether they're drinking clandestinely in places where it's not approved. So it's very difficult to get accurate data about how much an individual person drinks. That's one thing. People try to do it in specific studies, and there are methodologies to do it with on historical basis. And recently, some of those methodologies are now being improved by some blood tests that can be done to look at, that shows exposure to alcohol in the past 28 days, for example. But it's difficult to apply those sorts of tests in populations. You know, they are tests, they are studies that are done in numbers of 100 to 200 or 300. When we're now talking about millions, what about the millions of people that we're trying to consider? So that's the first problem with the alcohol data, is that it's difficult to get verifiable, accurate data. On the other hand, you and I are familiar with the Journal of Anecdotal Medicine. And so from the anecdotal point of view, alcohol is a really serious problem for practicing liver specialists. And if you look at the inpatient service in Jefferson, for example, where you work, in the University of Wisconsin, where I work, half of the patients with serious liver disease in hospital at any one time have serious alcohol problems. So it is the biggest reason for serious liver disease that we see. And that's not accounting for all the other ways that alcohol causes harm. It causes motor vehicle accidents, domestic violence, suicide, and then all the other injuries that it causes in the body, pancreatitis, neurological damage, dementia. And then you mentioned to me the recent interest of the American Cancer Society in alcohol. And they've been pointing out that alcohol affects breast cancer and esophageal cancer, cancers that we didn't previously link to alcohol. On the one hand, we don't have as accurate data as we would need. On the other hand, there is no doubt that drinking causes problems to health and the health of society. And what we're trying to do now is to find the safe margins, which is the more difficult task.
So I think, as you say, Michael, we can't, unless there were a blood test, and even that, men and women metabolize alcohol a little bit differently. If I'm correct, for our listeners again, you're a liver disease specialist and a liver transplant medicine specialist. And so women have less water volume than men, so we take the same amount of alcohol in as a man, and we don't dilute it as well, number one. Plus, we are have lesser amounts of the enzyme that metabolizes, it metabolizes the alcohol, so it lingers longer. And with age, too, doesn't the liver slow down when it metabolizes alcohol? And that's why with age we get tipsy a little bit faster.
Some hard to tell if the latter point is true, but more probably, from my view, the age issue is just accumulation of time. It's just repetitive injury, you know. So the liver, as you know, has great powers of recovery, but if you keep beating it down, eventually you'll get on top of it, and that's really so. That's part of so. It's the repetitive nature. Now, one of the things you asked me yesterday was, you said your listeners like patient stories, clinical vignettes. So I had a clinic today. So I saw a patient who several years ago had serious liver failure with accumulation of extra fluid in their abdomen. We call that ascites. And the tests have shown how their liver was working were all in disarray. That patient has now stopped all alcohol for several years, and those immediate effects have gone away. They no longer have the extra fluid in their abdomen. Their liver tests are back to normal. They still have a damaged liver, but they have restored their, so even after serious damage, withdrawal of this poison allows the liver to recover. It's quite remarkable. So That's the hopeful side of this story, is that even when things look the bleakest for somebody with alcohol-related liver disease, if we can find ways of helping them achieve abstinence and sustain it, many of them have a chance of recovering. There is a movement within the addiction world that says that's asking too much of people. Don't ask them an unreasonable thing to do. Give them something that's reasonable. So if they're drinking 6 drinks a day, every day, try to get them down to 3 drinks a day, 3 times a week. And then that's better than 6 drinks a day, every day. And I mean, I have patients who are drinking 24 beers a day, every day. So, you know, that is called harm reduction. And harm reduction is a good approach for addiction, but a bad approach for liver disease, because it appears that you really need to withdraw the alcohol. Is there a lower limit that would be tolerable? 1 drink every 3 days or 1 drink every week? We don't know that, and it might be different for different people. So for that reason, we tend to come across as being somewhat absolutist, maybe a little bit over severe, but the advice we give patients is that no drinking is safe under those circumstances.
And especially in pregnant women, there are so many things that we can refer to. We talked about the average person probably realizes that excess alcohol can damage the liver, or as you said, pancreatitis, heart disease. It bumps the risk for high blood pressure, stroke. You mentioned dementia. It can weaken the immune system. But I think the information that really surprises people that we're really trying to share is that it bumps the risk for multiple cancers. And we say, well, how does that happen? I initially thought, well, alcohol is one of those things that triggers reflux, and acid reflux bumps the risk for damage and esophageal cancer. But no, they're saying that the alcohol is converted to acetaldehyde, which is a chemical that can damage our DNA. And when you read this, you say, oh, you know, I wonder if that motivates people when we talk about it and say, you know, you think you're just having a drink after work, or you're celebrating an engagement or at a wedding or something, and you might think twice if you really hear that alcohol leads to stress in cells and damages DNA, and then those cells become habitually damaged and 10, 20 years down the road, yes?
Absolutely. And so it's the silent nature of the damage that is so unfortunate for the person who is sustaining it. It's not alone in that. The same is true of smoking. For example, it accumulates damage over a long time before the person knows. So that's why we're trying to inform people at a point in which they can change, and the change allows them recover and their tissues recover.
Sure, because alcohol really can enhance the damage of the harmful chemicals involved with tobacco smoke, and they feed off each other, and that's why there's an increased risk of mouth and throat cancer. Let's take a little break. True. And we'll be back to continue our discussion about how much alcohol is healthy to take.
Thanks for listening to Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, exclusively presented by Independence Blue Cross. If you have a question for the medical mailbag, just send a note to doctor@yourradiodoctor.net.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Welcome back to Your Radio Doctor. We are so pleased to have our guest, Dr. Michael Lucy from University of Wisconsin, a liver disease specialist and the former director of the liver transplant service at University of Wisconsin. And prior to that, we were fortunate to have him here in Philadelphia when he was at the University of Pennsylvania. Michael, we talked about long-term risks of moderate to excess alcohol intake. Some of the short-term risks you alluded to: motor vehicle accidents, falls, drownings, burns. You're not sharp and you put the curling iron down and you pick it up with your hand. Domestic violence, homicide, suicide, alcohol poisoning. You know, these kids go off to college and you just pray that they don't do the double dare. It's my 21st birthday, so I think I'll do 21 shots today. You know, you and I, you're a gastroenterologist like I am, but you have the extra training and interest in liver disease. But I will tell you, of the many young people I would see under age 30, I would take their history and say, oh, I have terrible reflux. And we know the triggers for reflux are the ENs: nicotine, caffeine, xanthine, which is too much chocolate or whatever. But alcohol is one of them. So I'd say to them, do you smoke cigarettes? Oh, no. Do you eat a lot of chocolate? Nope, my diet's perfect and I exercise and all. How about alcohol? Well, just one night a week. So I might say, these are maybe the under 30 patients, maybe like a six pack and a couple shots. And they're like, yeah, it just rolls off their tongues. And they don't, I think the mantra is, it's not drugs.
Yes, I think there are two.
And,
two,
you know, like the commercials, you drink this beer, you'll get the girl in the bikini, or you'll win the football game, I don't know.
I think each country has its own cultural background to this. And I think in the United States, the folk memory of the 18th Amendment is very powerful. You know, so amendment to prohibit the sale and transport of intoxicating liquor, and it was maintained for a relatively short time, although it took many years to reach the point where it achieved success as a constitutional amendment. So there's a long point going to it, and then it arrives. And in retrospect, it now appears that the unintended consequences of that amendment were far worse than the benefits that it provided. I think that has made it very difficult in the United States, this is just a personal opinion, a punditry, to promote things that would reduce people drinking, because it appears to be leading to something like prohibition. Mm-hmm. But what is working in other countries are things that raise the price of alcohol. So if the price is effectively raised, the amount that is consumed or purchased is reduced. And the persons who are drinking to excess continue to drink, but drink less. And this was introduced as a change of what was called the minimal price per unit, the MPU, the milliliter price per unit of alcohol, was introduced in Scotland, and it has now been also introduced in Wales and in Ireland. And in some of the countries of the Balkans, they have introduced increased taxation. That also works. So, I don't see that happening in the United States. I mean, so we just got to accept the way things are here. So currently, the official government guidelines on what is a safe amount are currently under review. And I think that's the next place where we may see some advice. It's going to be at the level of advice as opposed to making alcohol more expensive, mm-hmm. which is a more direct way of reducing excessive drinking.
Well, you know, I guess a good parallel would be melanoma, the skin cancer, and the tanning booths. How could they, at least on cigarette packages? We've interviewed the doctor who has a big role in writing the warning labels on cigarette packaging and tanning booths. I think in LA was one of the first places to put a tax on the cost of tanning booths. Just what you're saying. And
so I didn't know about that, Mary, but I do think the cigarette example is a very interesting one. You know, the Surgeon General issued his report that codified that cigarette smoking was associated with lung cancer and bronchitis and probably heart disease, what they said. And we have to check this up, but I think it was around 1962 or 63. And at that time in the United States, roughly half of the adults of the United States were smokers in the previous month. Now it's less than 20%. This hasn't happened just by one thing. It's happened by a whole series of things, including the labels on the boxes, raising taxes on cigarettes, reducing the opportunities of smoking in public places which are crowded, reducing advertising for cigarettes at sporting events. We would need a social understanding, a compact, that alcohol provided a similar risk to do something along the same lines with regard to alcohol. In my opinion, it does have such a risk, but times have changed. The Surgeon General doesn't have the same cachet and power to influence public opinion as the Surgeon General did 50 years ago.
So how can we improve the care of a patient who has some liver damage that we can detect with abnormal liver studies when we do their blood tests? Maybe we'll follow with an ultrasound, because I know fatty liver was the big conversation, still is, because people are retaining more weight. Obesity is more of an emblem, is more emblematic in our country now. But alcohol can cause fatty deposition in the liver as well, which can, in some cases, lead to inflammation and cirrhosis. If a person has some liver disease but not alcohol use disorder, that's one category. But then there are people that do have both.
You know, we have diagnostic criteria for alcohol use disorder, but many of the people who are getting injury at a low grade don't actually meet that diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And some of them will also have what you suggest as the layering on of other injurious aspects to their liver, particularly excess fat from metabolic syndrome, insulin insensitivity, obstructive sleep apnea, systemic hypertension, hyperlipidemia, that syndrome complex, and alcohol as well. So to get back to your first question, what is the safe level of alcohol? For those people, again, there is no safe level. You mentioned just at the end of the first segment, for pregnant women, there's no safe level. So for persons with metabolic syndrome, there is no safe level, even if they don't yet have abnormal liver tests, they should. For anybody with any chronic liver disease, there's no safe level. And then there's a whole series of other illnesses in which it's ill-advised to be drinking. I was sitting beside a man at a dinner party a few weeks ago, and this topic came up. The sort of standard bore about alcohol. And the wine bottle was being passed around, and he said, "Not for me. After my atrial fibrillation, I had to stop drinking alcohol." So that's not something we previously would have associated directly with alcohol, but he finds that he is in sinus rhythm if he doesn't drink, and he's at risk of going into atrial fibrillation if he does drink. So for persons who have a clear reason not to drink, we should give them unequivocal advice. And I'm sure you've heard the patient that is in your office who now has alcohol-related liver disease, and you say, "But I see that your liver blood tests were not right 4 years ago when you were having a colonoscopy or something. Did no one talk to you about that?" Mm-hmm. And the patient will say, "I was told to cut down." You know, patients are given very vague advice, or they're not even asked about alcohol. So where this starts, because I know that your listenership includes your primary care doctors and primary care providers, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, having the practice of asking about alcohol to everybody you see. And if you want three questions, the NIH is one question, which is just, do you drink alcohol? But if you just say three questions, in the past 12 months, did you have any alcohol? And if the answer is yes, in the past 12 months, how many days did you drink alcohol in a given week? And how often did you have five or more drinks at a time? One looking at sustained drinking, the other looking at binge drinking. The key there is, if you get positive answers, now you've got to say, maybe it's in a busy primary care clinic, you haven't time to spend more, they've got 10 people waiting to come in. You've got to say, "Now we've got to make an appointment to come back and talk to me about this, and we're going to talk about your alcohol use." That's so recognizing alcohol use where we previously didn't recognize it, and giving unequivocal advice about not drinking to those people who clearly are not in a position to sustain alcohol.
Well said. But I think too, when I would see somebody who's sent simply for colonoscopy screening, they say, "Oh, I have no symptoms," I still want to chat with them either before the, you know, at some point, and go over their labs, their routine labs. And if I find even the slightest abnormal liver function study test, I repeat them. And I never hesitate to get an ultrasound, because fatty liver is taking over the planet. And it's not always, as you say, it can be from excess alcohol, or alcohol, maybe not excess alcohol, but steady exposure to alcohol or too much weight. Or those LFT liver function tests can be abnormal from taking too much green tea extract. There's so many things that can play games with our liver studies. And I've had plenty of patients say, "Oh, I talked to my primary doc and they said they're just mild." Mild. They can be just mild and have a lot of fat in your liver. So it's good for people to hear this so they know. I mean, that's the whole purpose of our show. These are the questions we want you to ask your doctor. Let's take a little break and hear about this week's Real Champion. And when we come back, more from Dr. Michael Lucy from U, Wisconsin. And now for your Real Champion. I call this segment 1-800-GIRL-POWER. Lou and his wife, Tony, take great pride in keeping their seashore house in Ocean City, New Jersey, in meticulous condition. They live on a corner at an intersection near the bay, which captures a heavenly breeze that eliminates any need for air conditioning. That's one of the reasons why they consider their open porch their happy place. The other reason is because the porch has been the gathering place for creating years of precious memories, including the celebration of their 50th wedding anniversary. Well, following damage from Hurricane Sandy, they razed their duplex home to avoid any flood damage in future storms. That said, their first floor is now 10 steps off the sidewalk. So our story begins on a hot and sunny day just at the start of the summer. Lou is going about his annual ritual of taking four very large, very heavy Adirondack chairs out of the storage shed and lugging each chair up the steps to the porch. Picture an Adirondack chair, a classic outdoor chair featuring a slanted backrest, wide armrests, and a low, comfortable seat. Comfortable for sitting, but not comfortable to carry, especially since it's hard to find a good place to grip. So understand, there's a process. Much like Atlas carrying the world on his back, Lou methodically carries each chair up each of 10 steps onto the magical porch. How does he do it? By resting the chair on one knee and placing a foot of the chair on a step, then shifting the chair to his opposite knee to place the opposite foot of the chair on the next step. Exhausting? Yes, especially if you have arthritis in both knees. Well, Lou managed to lug the first chair to its rightful position on the royal balcony, but faced the challenge of three more grueling trips. He successfully navigated chair number two halfway up the steps, when suddenly he was surrounded by three very neighborly women who decided to step in and finish the job. Lou chuckles when he recalls the moment. Like a flock of seagulls, they swooped in for a landing. Charlene said, "I have this." Lou was almost finished saying, "It's too heavy." Just as the other two friends, Jeannie and Lisa, each took an arm and convinced Lou to come down the steps. He chuckles as he recalls the event. "It happened so quickly. Those chairs are heavy and I felt a little silly and embarrassed." But then he admits he was struggling. "It was something I'd never expect." Well, the goodwill continued because the women then insisted they finish the job and carry two more chairs up the steps. A week later, Tony brought gifts of wine and flowers along with a thank you note addressed to lovely lady 1, 2, 3, and 4. And there's more. Lou and Tony kindly invited the women for coffee one morning in August so I could hear their story. The women have been best friends for many years. All are now retired and share a great love for golf. In fact, that very morning they had played 18 holes, enjoyed lunch, and were headed home to get ready for the beach. Charlene was in the front seat as her friend Jill drove home. As they passed Lou and Tony's house, Charlene said, "Stop the car, stop the car," because she saw a white-haired man struggling to inch a heavy chair up a mountain and feared he would fall down the steps. Jill backpacked, made a quick turn, then Charlene, Jeannie, and Lisa sprinted to the rescue. It didn't take long to understand that these friends share more than a love of golf. Each of these thoughtful women has service in her DNA. Jeannie Sullivan was a nurse at Fox Chase Cancer Center for over 35 years, admired by all who encountered her great skills and compassionate care. Jeannie and Charlene Brennan went to the same high school, then on to LaSalle for college, where the two friends met Lisa Jasikowicz. Charlene and Lisa became bankers, helping people from all walks with planning for their futures, including retirement. Jill Sutton, the driver, hails from Georgia and became a pharmacist who rose in the ranks of a major pharma company to a leadership role where she trained executives. I later learned that each woman also devoted herself to join her respective siblings in the care for their elderly parents in their final stages of life. These women embody gratitude and pay it forward. They saw a man in need and jumped to help by a collective reflex. As we said our goodbyes, I was especially moved by the two last comments. Jeannie turned to thank Tony for the basket of gifts and was truly touched by Tony's handwritten thank you note, which we all can agree has become a lost art. And Charlene ended with, "Here's my phone number, Lou. Make sure you call us when it's time to put the chairs away." I'm going to guess the number has to be 1-800-GIRL-POWER. We salute you, Charlene Brennan, Lisa Jasikowicz, Jeannie Sullivan, and Jill Sutton, your real champions.
Today's edition of Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross, can be enjoyed anytime, anywhere, at your convenience. Just download the Odyssey app and search Your Radio Doctor. It's health education on demand.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Your radio doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, now Saturday afternoons at 5, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC.
Welcome back to Your Radio Doctor. We're learning so much from Dr. Michael Lucy, who is a liver disease specialist and transplant medicine specialist. Michael Lucy, it is such a pleasure to hear you speak. You're so logical and eloquent, and I'm learning so much. I mean, I'm a GI doctor too, but when I think about the points you're making about end-stage liver disease and nearly half the deaths from cirrhosis or from alcohol, but you know, we're doing a show next week on alcohol use disorder with a fantastic doctor, Dr. Wang, from this area. I chose to talk about alcohol and possible negative effects on our health today, not just because of the recent Wall Street Journal article, but because alcohol seems to take a backseat to other problems that lead to addiction, other drugs, etc., marijuana, because it's legal, it's readily accessible. What the heck? It was the liquor stores were considered essential and were left open during COVID. What? When more people were isolated and leaning toward alcohol, right? So it's legal, it's accessible, and it's socially acceptable. It's almost like you were starting to say, you were at a dinner party and somebody said, you know what? I'm avoiding alcohol for now. I don't want to go into AFib, which may or may not be related, but in that person's mind, that's a good deterrent. You walk into a party and say, oh, I have to get up early tomorrow. People think there's something wrong with you. There's almost a little pressure to imbibe, yes?
Yes, I think there are a number of interesting social forces in everything you say. It is true that, for example, the fentanyl crisis has taken huge attention because there are so many tragic deaths, very visible deaths. Persons in their early 30s and 40s, often employed with families who were using fentanyl and not realizing the dangers they were putting their health under and dying. Right. And then, so that's very tragic when that occurs. With alcohol, it's more insidious. And so many deaths are occurring without it being recognized quite to the same degree. However, when data on this have been looked at, two very good researchers from the University of Michigan, Elliot Tapper and Nihar Parikh, published a paper in British Medical Journal looking at changes in mortality from liver disease over the course of a number of years in the United States. And mortality from liver disease is rising in all age groups. The rise is all due to alcohol-related, cirrhosis-related deaths. So that's, they're not deaths from PBC and PSC. It's alcohol that is causing an increased death rate. But the greatest increase was in the 25 to 35-year-old group. So that's a change. So previously we saw alcohol-related disease as something of older people. They had to accumulate it. There was the stereotypical Bowery bum, you know, was the person who was the person with alcohol-related disease. That stereotype, if it were ever true, is not true now. So we're now seeing younger people. That's one problem. I'm going to contrast that just for 2 seconds with something else that's happening in society, which I think is quite interesting, which is the rise of not drinking. And you'll see this in Dry January. You'll see it in the rise of NA beer. NA beer is the largest growth part of the beer industry. Now, it's still less than 5% of the beer being consumed in the United States is non-alcoholic. But it does say that there is a new understanding, and I think it's getting to the point that you were making, Marianne, that to make it socially acceptable that when you're at a bar or in a person's home, that first of all, that they would have a non-alcoholic beer available in the same way that they might have a vegetarian dish if they were serving food.
Right.
And say, so that it's no longer drawing attention to yourself by saying, no, I'm not having anything to drink. And it may be that I've got a long drive to do. I don't want to be stopped and found that I'm over the limit. Or, you know, that there are many reasons why a person might choose not to drink. I'm working tomorrow, you know. So on the one hand, we see this growth of alcohol consumption leading to mortality, particularly in young people. And at the same time, we see a sort of counter movement of non-drinking or less drinking. And I think it would be interesting to observe over the next few years to see how these two sort out.
Well, that no drinking culture, you're right, Michael, it's making a mark. I know here in Philadelphia, in Manayunk, we did a show that included a bar in Manayunk where a husband and wife wanted to offer the same atmosphere of cheer and goodwill and let's get together for delicious food and zero proof libations. So that if a woman is pregnant or somebody's running a marathon the next day and they just want to go out and feel what you do, you know, in the Cheers TV show where everybody knows your name and you have that social interaction and the nice music and atmosphere, but you wake up without a headache or you wake up ready to run. But I think the other, I'm sitting here listening to you and I'm thinking, gee whiz, we're also seeing this massive rise in obesity. We're seeing colorectal cancer and other cancers causing mortality in much younger ages. So could it be the obesity causing fatty liver combined with alcohol causing fatty liver that's seeing this rise? And you also mentioned it's in the younger people, but it's more of a crisis in young women than young men. What's your theory there?
So this gets back to your earlier comment how women metabolize differently than men. But in the past, the prevalence of excessive drinking among women was much lower. So they were at greater risk, but we still saw far fewer women. This I'm referring particularly to liver disease here. We saw far fewer women with liver, alcohol-related liver damage than men, because far fewer women in the population, far a lower prevalence of women drank to excess. That is changing now. And so we're seeing an evening out between the sexes in their drinking habits. And again, this is a social question as to why this is. Much of it is to do with the pressures of 21st century life, the pressures success at work. I think the high standards people are set for having success in their family lives, the growth of loneliness. It's something that the current Surgeon General is concerned about appropriately.
Sure.
So all of those things may be playing into this greater reliance on alcohol. So you can see there are forces going in two directions here. One is trying to educate people about the dangers of alcohol and to helping them drink less. Even if it's not drink nothing, drink less.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, see these pressures that are actually related to drinking more. And you mentioned COVID, and sales of alcohol went up in the first year of COVID. Emergency room visits for persons with alcohol-related disorders went up in COVID. So COVID was one of those social pressures that seem to promote alcohol mm-hmm. consumption.
And as we said, ironically, the liquor stores remained open. You could even have it delivered to your doorstep, which kind of goes against the opportunity to say...
We know that neither of us did that, Marianne. Although here, you know, I'm in danger of a Pinocchio. We just have to be careful what we say on tape.
Well, I do know that I'm not a big fan of beer. But when I had the opportunity to go to Ireland, oh my gosh, can we just move there, Michael? I mean, I love my home here in America, but if I had to go
to another place... Well, you've got a friend in the president. I do know that he's waiting. So he'll certainly open the door for you, Marianne.
Well, I just know that when I went to Ireland, I drank a glass of Guinness every day. Even though I didn't love it, I did it for the homeland. So I'm proud of that.
Well, as I told you yesterday, when I was a medical student, I didn't. The hospital used to give Guinness to patients in hospital. because one of the Guinness's more famous sales pitches was Guinness is good for you. And now this is the shift in understanding. The most you can say is it's not that bad for you if you don't drink too much of it. But I don't think there's much case to be made that is actually good for you, in the way that you can make a very good case that coffee is good for you.
Right. Well, and my dear mother, her first pregnancy led to beautiful twin daughters. And she was told by her grandmother that if she drank a little Guinness every day, it would make better milk supply, because she was having two babies. So maybe that to my sister's a little goofy. I don't know, but you know, they're perfectly fine. But it's funny, these old wives' tales, and it does take, what we're talking about is public education, as you said, like with the cigarette packaging and and limiting, and it's multi-pronged. You can't just say don't drink.
It's multifaceted, and then it also relates, I think, to medical education, which is a more focused, and I think that's increasing the understanding of addictions in general, alcohol use disorder, and alcohol and the consequences of alcohol. And a lot written recently about stigma. So there's when you mention people might be embarrassed to mention that they're not drinking, that's really a reflection of stigma. And so removing the stigma from being an abstinent person, from making healthy choices, I think is important.
Well, two things before I forget. When a person does have liver disease, moderate to severe, we ask them to avoid Tylenol unless there's a certain, maybe a minimum of Tylenol a day. Can that worsen their situation?
So what I tell my patients is that they can take up to 2 grams, that's 4 extra strength Tylenol, in a 24-hour period. There are two types of Tylenol overdose. They're the people who are depressed and in despair. They're taking Tylenol excessively. But at least half of the clinical overdoses are accidental, from people not realizing the damage that they're undertaking. So it's quite easy to take 2 Tylenol, and it could be a toothache, it could be dysmenorrhea, it could be a sprained leg, and to take another 2 in an hour, and then take another 2 in another hour, and take another 2 in another hour, and you could easily consume 16 to 20, which would be 10 grams. In 6 or 8 hours, that's not that difficult to do. So it's important to set a limit, and the limit for everybody should be just 2 grams, no more. Mm-hmm. And then I think they will be okay.
That's 4 extra strength Tylenol
extra. 24 and they
hours.
Also need to be aware that Tylenol is in other things. Right. That also catches some people out.
So good point.
There are compound medicines that include Tylenol, cold medicines, for example. Mm-hmm. So you've got a driving headache, a stuffed nose, you've got to work, I've got to do something about this, I can't keep. And so you're sort of shoving these things in, you don't realize that you're taking as much as you are.
We're going to take a little break, but I hope we have time in the last segment, Michael, to talk about your brilliant idea that there should be one place. It's almost unfortunate that we take care of the physical negative results of alcohol damage in a different place than helping people in recovery. So let's take a little break and we'll come back for our wrap up.
Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie is presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Welcome back to our final segment of Your Radio Doctor. We have learned so much from our friend, Dr. Michael Lucy from the University of Wisconsin, hepatologist extraordinaire and director of liver transplant medicine at U Wisconsin. Michael, we live in a culture that includes those who have a glass of wine at the end of a busy work day, or make sure the fridge is stocked with cold beer to watch the football or basketball game. So one of the things I gleaned from that Wall Street Journal article that started our conversation was that the writer asked, a question that a lot of lay people might ask. Is the risk the same if a man has two drinks on the same day compared to having one drink on two different days? And is it risky if a person has three drinks on a special occasion, like at a wedding, but otherwise minimal or moderate intake?
So there are two parts to the answer. One, it depends on who that person is. We were talking earlier about other additional risks. We were particularly stressing the condition metabolic syndrome with increased circumferential weight, so weight around the middle, the pear-shaped person who's got higher blood pressure, who might have sleep apnea, might have elevated blood lipids, fat in their blood. So that person is at higher risk from even small amounts of alcohol. And it may not be terribly healthy for that person even to have one drink. Now, how high is that risk is hard to say. And so they may wish to accept that risk. You know, we mentioned about the risks of riding a bicycle or driving a car. There are some risks that are easy to avoid. So if you're driving a car, it's easy to avoid the risk of not putting on your seatbelt. Just put on your seatbelt. You can still drive the car. So the with regard to beer, having one beer, even for somebody with extra risks, might not be that risky. Two might be more. So they actually have to understand that it's an individual thing. However, it's not a good thing ever to have five or six drinks. And what's interesting is that that's not that uncommon.
Right.
So here in Wisconsin, even though they lost last week, I'm commonly told by people that they don't drink, except when the Packers are on. As if the Packers gave their body some sort of protection from the injurious effects
immunity
that would happen on any other day or afternoon of the week. So under those circumstances, greater care would be wise. Again, the person has to make their own judgment. So this is drinking at less than alcohol use disorder. So alcohol use disorder is something more severe, and it is always dangerous. So we now got a group of people who we're giving advice about never drinking. Alcohol use disorder, women while pregnant, persons with chronic liver disease of any kind, persons with other diseases that are made worse by drinking. What you're now asking about the rest of the population, and in those cases they have to make their judgments. What I tell patients, but my patients generally come with liver disease, so they're getting the "you shouldn't be drinking" talk. But outside that, maybe their spouse who is sitting beside them, if they ask a question, it's if you haven't other risk factors and you're not drinking on every day, so you've got some non-drinking days, one or two drinks is probably quite safe.
Well, I think you give a message of hope always, Michael, because one of the things we learned today from listening is that the liver can regenerate, maybe not completely, but it can regenerate if a person stops drinking. And I was reading an article the other day that, and social media doesn't help because it brings up these daredevil ideas like hand sanitizers are now posing a problem because young kids on a dare will drink hand sanitizer knowing there's alcohol in it. What? So we have to continue to educate parents and watch for things.
Well, I was going to say two quick things. One, I've got to give you a Philly reference. So all of your Philly listeners need to go into the Institute of Art, if that's the correct title of it, the one that Rocky ran up the steps to. And if you go inside there's an absolutely magnificent painting by Peter Paul Rubens. It fills a wall, and it's of Prometheus. If you remember, Prometheus stole fire from the gods, and he was a titan, so he was an immortal, and so his his, he was certainly an immortal, whether he was a titan or not, I better be careful, but he was an immortal, and so he couldn't die. So he, his punishment was that he was chained to a rock, and every day a bird picked away his liver, and every night it grew again. So that's the recovery of the liver. It's Promethean. So, and it's actually a great picture. I recommend, I often just go to see it when I visit my all too infrequent visits to Philly. So that's one thing. The other is, where, if they're not going to go to the art gallery in Philly, where are people going to get sound information that isn't telling them to drink Purell from the hand sanitizer or other wacko ideas? And the place I would go is to the National Institutes of Health. And it has an institute about alcohol and its damage called the NIAAA. And if you go, if you just put NIAAA into Google or National Institutes of Health into Google and go into the search part and put alcohol, their page is excellent. It has information for physicians, nurses, and other medical professionals. It has information for members of the lay community. And it's not scary. It's not looking to be moralistic or overbearing. And so I think that's where I would direct people to go and get more. If they're interested in getting more information, go to the National Institutes of Health webpage, and particularly the institute related to alcohol.
The NIAAA stands for National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, with great information. Dr. Michael Lucy, brilliant as always. What a pleasure. And we're going to have to lasso you and bring you back to Philly once or twice a year, so we can go to the art museum. Yeah, and
yes, I mean, I go to the art gallery along with seeing you, Marianne.
Of course.
They're the two things we can do.
Well, we'll have to cheer with some apple cider. Root beer. Root beer. No, thank you so much, Michael.
I would have a glass of Schuylkill water.
That'll definitely help your immune system.
You know, if there's eating and drinking in it.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to your Radio Doctor every Saturday afternoon at 5 here on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. Listen again to any of our shows or Real Champion segments on Audacy.com. That's AUDACY.com. A special thank you to our exclusive sponsor, Independence Blue Cross, for their continued support. Tune in next week to hear about a very important topic, alcohol use disorder. When we talk about addiction, I often think alcohol use disorder takes a backseat to drug addiction because alcohol is legal, easily accessible, and socially acceptable. Yet more people die from excess alcohol intake in 2022 than drug addiction. It's September, Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. To our men out there listening, please take time for an annual physical and make sure not to ignore any symptoms related to your bathroom habits. And please remember to pray for peace in our world, peace in our beloved country as we approach the election, peace in our families, and peace in each of our own hearts. This is your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, wishing you a happy, healthy, and safe week with the ones you love. Always here to remind you that your health is your wealth.
Thanks for listening to your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross. To contact Dr. Marianne and to listen to today's show as well as past shows, visit yourradiodoctor.com. This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Audacy. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.